Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We'll start the show discussing help that's out there for Vermont small businesses. Next, we'll visit the Percy Farm in Stowe to see how it's rebounding after a fire back in February. At 10, we'll try on some beautiful locally made sweaters, and we'll finish the morning hearing about the legal concerns former President Trump is having. But first, let's focus on small businesses and startups. The Vermont Economic Development Authority, or VEDA, is really keyed into this part of the state's economy, and there are more ARPA funds that will help these businesses in Vermont. Joining me to discuss how VEDA is working with small businesses and startups is VEDA's CEO, Cassie Palemas. Cassie, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. It's great to be back again.
It's great to have you. Listeners, to ask Cassie a question or share a comment, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Cassie, give us an overview of what VEDA's mission is.
Sure. So VEDA is a lending institution. We're not a bank. We don't take deposits, but we do make loans for all kinds of businesses. So agriculture, clean energy, energy efficiency, EV charging stations at business locations, and then, of course, loans to businesses. So this includes everything from startups and entrepreneurial borrowers to many of Vermont's well-known and established businesses. But I want to note, we don't do all of this work alone. We have many partners that help us in this work. We work with all the banks and credit unions and non-traditional lenders like community loan funds and micro lenders, as well as state and federal agencies to put together a loan structure that works for the borrower. So we're not, you know, some people think of us as the lender of last resort. That is not what VEDA does. What VEDA does is make a project work, because we come in and we can provide some slightly more at-risk capital that helps some of the other lenders in a project be comfortable with their risk thresholds. So in most cases, VEDA is one of at least two lenders in a project. The exception to that, I would say, is our agricultural sector, which you and I have talked about in the past, Rick. Here we are generally the primary lender because there are not a lot of other lenders in the state that have the ability to provide the right type of capital for some of the unique risks of lending to agriculture.
And how
so
is...
Go ahead. I was going to say, it's a longer answer probably than you were looking for. It's hard to sum up what we do in one or two sentences. But, you know, I could tell you what our mission is, which is to provide financing solutions to support the economic vitality of the state of Vermont. But I wanted to put it in terms that sort of resonated hopefully with a lot of your viewers here, and that is that we provide financing for all kinds of businesses across many sectors.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And how is VEDA financed? How is it governed?
So we are what's called an instrumentality of the state of Vermont. And that means we're not an agency of the state. We're not funded directly by state taxpayer dollars. We actually fund our loans by borrowing from other institutions. We borrow from larger banks and then turn around and lend out that money. But we are an instrumentality, so we do have indirect support from the state. And we were created by the legislature back almost, well, we're coming up not too far from 50 years ago that VEDA was created. We have a staff of about 43 seasoned, experienced lenders and other staff that help us do this work, and we are governed by a board of directors. We have 15 members on our board. Five of our members are there because of their position with the state, and then 10 are Vermont residents that are appointed by the governor.
Well, Cassie, we're going to focus on small businesses this morning. How are things looking overall for Vermont's small business owners?
You know, I think I probably have a long answer to that question there, too, Rick.
Okay.
It's
all right.
A great question, but it's complicated. You know, I would say the short answer is things right now look good, at least from the outside, right?
Mm-hmm.
Restaurants are bustling and hotels are booked and tourists are back and farmers markets are doing well and selling out. Lots of concerts and events are well attended. But I think if you ask many business owners, they might tell you everything isn't as rosy as it looks. And I don't think it's new news to anybody that might be listening that the most frequent worry is finding labor. And we see that everywhere. So businesses might be booming, but they might have to cut back their hours. And it's not just retail and hospitality. We see it in the manufacturing and technology sectors, too. So it's not just a question of hiring the right worker, but also can that worker find a place to live in Vermont? It's all connected. But I would say generally there's cautious optimism out there. The past 2.5 years hit businesses unequally. Many closed, but many have new ways of doing business. And so we at Vita are seeing a fairly steady demand for loans to help businesses grow or start right now. But it's also getting more expensive to borrow, right? Interest rates are going up. So some businesses might feel they need to get ahead of even higher rates. So there's that uncertainty right now that still looms very large out there.
Well, you mentioned, Cassie, businesses starting. So how has that been as far as startups in Vermont? Are we seeing, you know, more than normal, about the same, or is it lagging behind?
You know, I think time will tell a little bit with that. I can say from our experience at Vita, during the height of the COVID, so 2020 and 2021, we financed close to 80 either startups or businesses that changed ownership.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't drop off the cliff, so to speak, as far as businesses taking that risk or people taking that risk to buy a business. Not quite the same level as pre-pandemic, you know, down a little bit, but it was still there. So I think, you know, that's a good sign.
Right.
I think it's an indicator that people want to do business in Vermont despite the challenges of housing, as I said earlier. You know, but some employers are, you know, the ones that can afford it, they're desperately trying to solve that problem by, you know, maybe buying up or building housing themselves so that the people that are here can actually live here and work here. So it's, you know, I think it's a mixed experience, and time will tell what that means.
Yeah, there have been businesses I've spoken to who say business is strong, but it could be so much better if they had more people. They're ready to expand, but they're kind of being held back by staffing right now. The other thing, and we'll get to the challenges first, Cassie, and I promise we'll get to the positive side of things after that. But supply chain is next. So have small businesses been impacted with supply chain problems like other businesses have?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we certainly saw that during the pandemic, firsthand when you went into the grocery stores, and then the silver lining was that benefited the local food producers, right?
Right.
But the reality is not everything can be sourced locally. So many, many manufacturers here in Vermont are feeling the supply chain problems. But you know, perhaps one that many of us have felt is just building supplies. Hard for contractors to get the supplies they need, and they're also hit by inflation. So we have seen more than one project either been canceled or have to be scaled back because of the scarcities caused by the supply chain issues and then the rising cost. So, yeah, it's a problem for sure.
Cassie, what is VITA's role in working with small businesses to keep them going and hopefully growing?
So, Rick, we, as I explained earlier, we provide varying types of loans and capital financial support for businesses of all sizes. It's often harder for startups to find adequate capital because of the inherent risks in a startup. So that's where VITA plays a key role. Is we work with other banks often, or credit unions, or other lenders, or depending on the amount, we might have to or can be the sole lender in helping a business start up that has a good plan that creates good quality jobs for the state of Vermont, which is in line with our mission and to support, you know, Vermont's economic strength and vitality. So I'd say that's a real central piece to what we do.
Let's talk about the $57.9 million investment program, the ARPA funds. I think it's called the Small Business Credit Initiative. What is this money specifically designed to do?
Well, this program is, as you said, it's part of the ARPA money coming to the state of Vermont. It's a separate slug of money, if you will. It's not part of the $2 billion that the state received through the COVID relief package. So this is, you know, I want to point out it's the second time that this program has come around. But what's different from the first time, which was back in 2010, is the amount of money. So it was $13 million back in 2010. This time it's $58
million. Yeah.
As well as where the state is using half of this money for venture capital investments. So VITA is the what's called the implementing entity. In other words, the money is state coming to the state, but the state is using VITA as a receptor of this money, if you will, to then put together the programs to deploy the money. So VITA will use half of the money to make loans, which is what we do day in, day out. And then, as I said, what's new this with this pot of money is half of it is going to go to venture capital fund managers. And those fund managers will be able to use this money over the course of the next 9 years to invest in startups, high growth stage companies, rural technology companies, medical technology companies, a wide range of interesting and important businesses that will have access to this money that is really unprecedented for the state of Vermont.
And Cassie, why does having half of it with these investment bankers, you know, why is that important? Why is that? Why do that as opposed to keeping that all within VITA and using it as loans?
Well, you're really talking about two very different needs out there. So, you know, when businesses are looking for capital, one of the very important questions they need to ask is what is the best structure of that capital? And what is going to be the, you know, least expensive for that business? A lot of investments that venture capital entities or fund managers make are not really bankable, if you will, or it's not, they're not ready. They don't have, say, the cash flow already generating to repay that loan.
Gotcha.
So it might take a different type of capital that is going to not need to be repaid immediately. It can be, you know, an equity investment, say, or a different type of investment. So that's all part of the equation in determining, you know, what is the best money, what is the right amount of money. Those are all important questions when somebody is starting a business or growing a business.
Let's say,
so while, you know, you think of a bank usually, but it's not always the bank that's the right answer.
Yeah, excellent point. Let's take a call from East Corinth. Forbes is joining us. Good morning, Forbes.
Good morning. How are you?
Well.
Just as a point of interest, but might it not be advisable to take a look and see what the needs are within Vermont, you know, at 1 through 10? And try to earmark some of those voids in services or businesses that could enhance the state.
So, Forbes, you're saying identify specific types of businesses we do need right now in Vermont?
Yes.
Okay, great question. Cassie?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a really good question, and that really speaks to a lot of the work that VITA does. And, you know, back to this, SSBCI money, it really will be going towards economic development initiatives that are important to the state, which is businesses that create quality jobs or businesses that are in sectors such as clean energy, medical technology, agriculture, agritourism. These are all important sectors to the Vermont economy, as well as underserved communities, underserved populations, making sure that the money reaches all the pockets and communities that often get overlooked. Mm. So that is all part of this program.
How does a business apply, and when will these funds start to be distributed?
So from VITA's perspective, for the loan programs, this is already available. And so it's not, there's no specific application for this program. What we're doing is using the money to be able to offer loans with lower rates. Mm. So extremely important right now in this rising interest rate environment where everything is getting more expensive. So this will make our lending less expensive for the borrowers. The venture capital piece is not quite ready. We're working on agreements with different fund managers to be able to start implementing the venture capital piece.
Yeah. And Cassie, what do you hope will be the net effect once these funds are put into play? I think you said up to over the next 9 years.
Yeah. Well, so a couple things. One, I just want to mention again that this money will be used in partnership with private capital. So one important objective is that this federal money is leveraging private capital. It's not just all federal money going into a particular loan transaction. Mm-hmm. So the goal is to, for every $1 of federal money, there's $10 of private capital that's also going in to help these projects. And then the other goal, of course, is, you know, to create the quality jobs. When VITA did the first round of SSBCI back that started in 2010, each project that we financed on average created about 10 jobs. So it was very successful, and we leveraged that money 13 times. So for every dollar of SSBCI money, $13 of private money also went into those projects. And that's important from the success of a program like this.
Absolutely.
So that's what we hope to get out of it, is to be able to to do that again and help the businesses create the jobs and have the private sector participate as well.
We've got about a minute and a half left. I hate to bring up another subject, but this is an important one. You know, the area of long-term care and elder care facilities. I think this is a concern of some of our listeners who have called in the past to discuss it. Can you talk about that sector and how VITA works to kind of bolster that?
Absolutely. Thanks for asking that. This is an area that we saw as needing more access to different types of capital. VITA had been able to participate in helping these organizations with only our bond program. So that's just one tool that we were able to use. But this past legislative session, the state, the legislators, gave us the ability to use other tools in our toolbox. And so now we can make loans to these critical and labor-intensive providers of services such as memory care and mental health, assisted living, even independent living, so that they have access to capital to expand those critical services and the quality of the services that they provide. So, again, VITA is just one source to help. But it's a step in the right direction to being able to help these critical organizations.
That's encouraging and great to hear. Cassie Palemis is the CEO of the Vermont Economic Development Authority. To learn more about VITA, you can visit VITA.org. Cassie, thanks for being on the show and sharing this information this morning.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me, Rick.
You're welcome. Excellent. We're going to take a break for CBS News and then return to find out how things are at the Percy Farm in Stowe. And tonight, the Sox have the night off, so we have the full Brady Farkas show, followed by Jazz with George Thomas from 7 to 9, and then Eye on the World with John Batchelor. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. In early February, we woke up to the staggering news of a barn fire in Stowe. At the Percy Farm, more than 100 cows perished in the fire. The Percy family started their dairy operation at the farm 1 year before WDEV went on the air. 6 months have passed since the fire, and this morning we're going to learn about the long, proud history of the farm, how the business has weathered the fire, and how the family farm has diversified through the years. Joining me now is the current patriarch of the family, who has a long memory of the dairy operation, Paul Percy. Paul, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning.
Good morning. Great to have you here. Listeners, if you've got a question for Paul or have memories of the Percy Farm, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Paul, how did the Percys come to live on Percy Farm, which had previously been, I think, the Weeks Farm?
Right. My grandmother was living with my parents up in Sheffield, and back in them days, there was a Raleigh salesman that come around, a traveling salesman.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to my grandmother, or my grandmother said to him, "You don't know of some nice old gentleman, he's a housekeeper." And he said, "Yes, I do. He lives down in Stowe. And I'll tell him about you." And sure enough, this guy, Allie Weeks, came over to Sheffield, and my grandmother ended up coming over here and keeping house for him for a few years. And finally, they ended up getting married, and my father and mother sold the farm in Sheffield and moved over here and took care of Allie Weeks and my grandmother until they both died. And my dad ended up with the farm, and I took care of him, and I ended up with the farm.
Wow. You were burnt.
So that's how we ended up here.
Yeah.
So back when they came here, there was no skiing.
Oh, right.
It was before ski lifts there, and there was lots of farms. Like on this hill where we live now, there was, I don't know, like 18 farms that were shipping milk to the Milkman Sale Co-op Creamery that was down in the village.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Yeah, you were born in 1940. So when did you get put to work on the farm there, Paul?
Well, my dad had a, I don't know, stroke or something, and I was 14 years old when all that took place. So if we was going to keep the farm, my brothers didn't really like farming and didn't have anything to do with it. And I ended up milking the cows before I went to school and when I got home, and I did that all through high school. We had a guy that would come in and milk once in a while when I wanted to go to a ski race, but and then my dad got a little better, but he never really got too good. He lived another 7-8 years after that, but 10 years, I guess. But I actually took over in 1965.
Wow. You a good ski racer back in the day, Paul?
Well, we used to go to the races, and you know, I weren't no world champion, but hey, I had a lot of fun doing it.
Now, has the Percy Farm always been a dairy farm?
Yes. Yeah. The barn that burnt was built back in the 1800s, and it has had several additions and remodeling jobs. Mm-hmm. I remodeled it twice. But it amazed me how fast, once they got a fire, how fast it all went. Boy, it went in a hurry.
Yeah.
They called the fire department at 11:30 at night, and by 2 o'clock, there was nothing left.
Oh, my.
Fire department stayed there until morning, but there was nothing left at 2 o'clock. You know, it was just a few hot spots that were still burning.
Right. What's the largest the herd's ever been there at the Percy Farm, Paul?
You can have, if you had it full, you could have about 150 in there. There was 130 at the time.
Mm.
No young stock to speak of. Well, we had 5 calves out in the horse barn, the adjoining building there, but that got a fire too and burned. We got the calves out. We took them out, but all the cows perished with the fire.
What else have you all raised there on the farm, at the Percy Farm?
Well, years ago, we used to have turkeys. At one point, they had sheep. Of course, we had horses years ago when I was a kid. We got rid of them in 1947. And we did maple syrup. We're into the maple syrup business.
Yep.
I actually don't tap the sugar bush that my dad had. I bought one up the road in 1961, and we've been tapping that one every since.
How many taps you put in?
About 20,000.
Whoa. Oh, my gosh. That is some work right there. Hey, Paul, we got this nice note from Charlie in Brookfield, and he wrote, after my father was killed in 1959, I made my way to the Percy Farm and was basically raised by Elton and Leona Percy. Paul's a little over a year older than me. I stayed there for over 20 years and built a herd of Jerseys, but left the farm in 1980. Those were the best years of my life. Paul's father and mother were the most wonderful people you could ever know, and they helped a young boy become a man. It's a beautiful note from Charlie Taplin down in Brookfield.
Well, it is beautiful, and I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What were your parents like, Paul?
Well, my mother stayed home all the time. She never worked anywhere, ever. She usually raised a good garden and cooked us a lot of meals. Of course, there was 5 of us kids, and then I always had my grandmother was here the whole time. So we had a full house. I don't know. I don't know why my grandmother wanted to stay with my father and mother, but she did. She lived with them the whole time that I grew up.
Hmm.
She died in 1961. My grandfather, Larry Weeks, died in 47. So he was here for 7 years after we came.
Oh, gosh.
And then my grandmother lived until 61. She lived quite a while afterward.
Well, you've been farming there for, I'm going to guess, about 70 years. Have you ever had thoughts of any other occupation?
No. You know, somebody asked me why I was so successful.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it was WCAX-TV reporter that asked me that. And I said, well, there's lots of ways of figuring out what success is.
Yeah.
And my way of looking at success is whether you've been happy with your life or not, and whether you've been able to do what you like to do, and whether you're satisfied with your life and don't wish you'd done something else. And all of them things is very positive to me. I'm happy with it. I've been involved in the community. I've been involved with Agamark. I've had a full life, and to me, that's been success.
And, Paul, I'm a city kid, and when I come out and see what it takes to be a dairy farmer, it's staggering to me how you all do it. What is it that you enjoy so much about being a farmer?
Well, I like growing the crops. I like growing corn. I like raising the animals. I like the whole thing. Now, I'm going to tell you there's some things I don't like doing. Like I'm not too excited about picking stone.
Right.
But agriculture has changed so much in my lifetime that it ain't even the same thing today that it was, you know, when I was a kid.
Yeah.
The equipment and the invention of all these different machines and everything you do is done with machines today. There's very little handwork on a farm today. It used to be that you could have most anybody doing all this handwork, and you'd find some people that weren't educated very much. You know, that don't work today. You take a $50,000 tractor, you want somebody that knows something about running a piece of machinery when you're driving that.
Yeah.
You know, it's a whole different ball game.
Yeah, and you get up in that cab now, it's highly computerized, highly technical compared to some of the equipment you've had through the decades.
Oh, yeah, the new stuff is really complicated.
Yeah,
it's also complicated to repair.
And
we try to repair all our own machinery, and the newer it gets, the more complicated it gets. It's like new cars. You almost got to take them to a dealer to get them repaired.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, where's the right computer chip to replace with this one? Paul, when did your family become part of the Agrimark Cabot Cooperative, and why did that make sense for your farm and your family?
We shipped our milk to a co-op called Milk Mansfield Co-op, and at one time it went out of business. And what it actually did is merged with Washington County Co-op.
Mm.
And when that all took place, my dad started shipping to Hood up in Morrisville.
Right.
We were selling milk in cans, and Washington County Co-op eventually merged with Cabot Cooperative. And along came bulk tanks and these trucks that come around and pick it up. And my dad had the opportunity to get on the truck coming out of Newport for Hood. And we put a bulk tank in 1953. And we started shipping our milk to Hood in Newport. Well, eventually, when I took over, I don't know exactly what year it was, we ended up, back up a little bit. We also were members of NEMPA, and that's a New England Milk Producers Association.
Mm-hmm.
But we shipped our milk to Hood. NEMPA merged with United Farmers and Connecticut Milk. And they formed a cooperative called Yankee Milk.
Oh.
And Yankee Milk, I was then a member of Yankee Milk. Now, Yankee Milk was in existence for a few years, and then they merged with or they bought the hood company was Agway. Agway and Yankee Milk bought the hood company. And we were members of that and shipped milk for a while there. And then Agamark got out of the... Agamark was formed when we bought the hood company.
Mm.
It changed from to Agamark at that point. And Agamark was in business with Agway for a few years, and then it didn't work very good, and Agamark got out of the hood company deal, and Agway bought it and took it over, bought it from us. And then shortly after that, we merged with Cabot Cooperative Creamery.
Gotcha.
And it became Agamark, and Cabot became a brand name. And that happened in 1980.
Okay. Now, how are things at the Percy Farm now, 6 months after the fire, Paul?
Well, we're in the process of trying to figure out what to do.
Yeah.
This is because that barn was totally gone.
Yeah.
I've got another farm where we milk cows, and we added a few more cows over there. And we got to figure out what we're really going to do and how we're going to do. We're looking at a robot barn, trying to figure out why we should build it and what the best thing to do is. We've been looking at barns to figure out how to build them. You know, I built the barn. We call it the Bouchard Farm. Around 1990, well, since 1990, they've changed barns quite a bit.
Yeah.
All the stalls are longer.
Right.
The whole thing is different. So we're looking at how we could update that barn, add on a few more cows because we need, you know, the amount of feed that we have and the land that we got, we need another 100 cows to milk approximately. I can milk, you know, nowadays everybody has kind of a base that they can produce milk up to a certain level. They've kind of limited how much milk a farm can produce, and
oh, right.
And I could add another 100 cows to what's at the Bouchard Farm, which is basically what we had up here at the home farm,
mm-hmm.
And I would still be within my base that I've allocated.
Good.
So we're looking at all that and trying to figure out what the best thing to do, and eventually we'll probably add another barn on somewhere, do something. But
that's great to hear.
You know, we're trying to plan it and do it right.
Now, after the fire, Paul, the town, the surrounding community really stepped up for the Percy Farm. What are some of the things that were done to help y'all?
It's kind of unbelievable.
Yeah.
The amount of reaction that came from the town. And I never heard of a GoFundMe thing, but they started a GoFundMe thing. The people in town did.
Yeah.
And we got a considerable amount of money through that GoFundMe thing to help us rebuild and help us continue and make it all work, which I appreciate very much. And I don't know all the people that gave it, but I would like to thank them all anyway for coming around and helping us out.
Well, it's given back to what the Percy Farm has given to the community all these decades. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about your corn maze. You have diversified in that way. So tell us about the corn maze there at the Percy Farm.
Well, years ago, I was, of course, they built that bike path, and I was on the planning commission when they did it. And you know, I said to myself, "What's this dream here? And how much is that going to cost the town?" And so the lawyer that presented it to us, when he got all done presenting it, I says, "You know, it's a fine idea, but who's going to pay for all that?" Oh, he says, "You ain't got to worry about it." He says, "There's an anonymous donor that's going to build it all." And they did. But, you know, people that live along that bike path donated some money to the donated some land so that they could build a right away along there so that they could have a place to put it.
Yep.
And I've got a lot of it along my land because I got a farm right along the edge of the river. And, you know, I was standing there watching all these people go by, and I heard about the corn maze. I didn't dream it up. Somebody just,
sure.
I said, boy, I ought to put a corn maze down there. Look at the people I got going right by there all the time. So I did. We opened it up and put a corn maze in there, and now it's like 17, 18 years old.
Wow.
Been there. And I really figured I was successful with it when the people that own the lodge owners start advertising that the corn maze is open.
Wow. Well, it sounds like the smartest idea.
Every single year.
Yeah. So when is it open during the week? What are the times? What days and times?
We keep it open 7 days a week. If it isn't running, if it isn't raining, if it starts raining, of course, nobody wants to go to corn maze. But every day that it isn't raining, we have the corn maze open. It opens at 10 o'clock, and we close it at 5.
Mm. Well, Paul Percy, I'm so glad that you had time to spend with me this morning. I know things are quite busy on a farm. Listeners, to learn more about the Percy Family Farm in Stowe, you can visit percyfarm.com. Paul, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome, and thank you.
You're welcome. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we'll return to talk about the beautiful creations of Muriels of Vermont. And we're coming up this morning at 11 o'clock. It's Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Sengary. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at wdevradio.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. A couple of weeks ago, I went up to the Champlain Islands Farmers Market because it's that time of year for the amazing peaches grown by Pampacalas. As I pulled in, my car was right in line with a vendor's booth. There on a mannequin was the most beautiful woman's sweater in a lovely shade of lilac, blue, probably lavender. And while I wear men's clothes most of the time, I still had to check out the sweaters on offer there. The company is Muriels of Vermont. And joining me now to talk about their farm-to-closet sweaters, vests, tanks, and sweater dresses is Cyrus Brooks. Cyrus, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Cyrus about Muriels of Vermont, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Explain what Muriels of Vermont is.
Well, Muriels of Vermont is a garment company that my mom and I created. I want to say we came up with the idea for it 4 or 5 years ago at this point. We've been operating for about 3 years. I say garment company. We definitely started with sweaters, beautiful wool sweaters with local Vermont wool, but have expanded into, like you said, tank tops and vests and sweater dresses. So we do a variety of garment styles now.
And yeah. You do men's too. I should make sure that people understand that.
Yeah, no.
I focused on the woman's sweater I saw there. And neither you nor your mom are named Muriel. So why did you choose that name for the company?
We actually named the company after my Nana. Her name was Muriel Jacoby. People called her Mickey, but she was a big hand knitter and also a big buy a local advocate, you know, back when the movement was really first starting. They lived in Underhill, Vermont for a while. I don't want to get the years wrong,
That's
but
right.
It was back in the day. And, you know, she was always all about going to buy, you know, the local milk and the local cheese and the fresh bread and, of course, local beautiful Vermont wool. And she would use that to hand knit a lot of things for my mom and her other kids and, you know, eventually her grandkids. So we kind of named it Muriels as an homage to her.
When did you start making sweaters? Were you knitting with needles? What?
No,
what
I actually, I don't even know how to hand knit, which is a little embarrassing considering that I make knitwear. But it was so my mom had basically a hand crank knitting machine. So it's not like needles. It's like a series of needles laid out on a bed, and you move basically a carriage along the bed with your hands to make small pieces, and then you link them together, and you can make scarves, mittens. Theoretically, I think you could make a sweater on that level of knitting machine. But we basically were looking for that technology on a bigger scale in order to be able to, like, really produce sweaters quickly and consistently. And so that's when we started doing research. And we basically found the technology, and that kind of inspired us to say, hey, well, this could be a legitimate business, and we could actually do something with these sweaters.
And it's one thing. I mean, they're beautifully made. They're really solid. But the texture of them, the design is what – from across the parking lot, I could see. I ran up to it. I had to touch it. I probably did.
Yeah, no.
He's wearing one right now, and I think I did the same thing.
It's great. It's so flattering, really. Because, I mean, yeah, we've done a lot of work kind of developing our designs and our styles, and that's been a lot of, like, kind of trial and error even. And also a big part of it is just sourcing really good fiber.
Which we'll talk about because you're finding that locally, which is really great. Some local, some not. What is it that you have enjoyed about working with cotton and wool and doing this as a business?
I mean, personally, it's been so incredible to see something go from, like, a design on a computer and then someone's wearing it out in the world. And it's great when people try them on and you're at the farmer's market booth and they look good, and that gets me so excited to see them in this beautiful sweater. And then it feels even better when they wear it without you, like, putting it on them, you know?
Right.
So the other day I was working Burlington Farmer's Market, and a woman just showed up to the farmer's market in my sweater. And she was like, yeah, it was kind of cold, and this was the sweater I go to now. So it feels so good to see it actually, like, incorporate into people's wardrobes as a staple piece, as something that, you know, isn't just this special sweater that you bought to support the mission. It's actually something that you want to wear out all the time.
Right. Well, give us a run through. I kind of mentioned some of the products, but make sure people know all the things that Muriel's makes and sells.
We definitely started focusing on the Vermont wool, the local wool. And with the wool, we honestly are, I guess you could say, our flagship sweater, if you will, was basically a chunky turtleneck, classic, warm, you know, slightly oversized turtleneck picture curling up by a fire, middle of Vermont winter with a cup of hot chocolate and a good book.
So very Vermont.
Yes. And and so then we were looking at other things. We do, like, a V-neck in the wool for, you know, some people don't want the turtleneck around their neck. Also, right. Just different styles for different outfits, right? And then we do, like, a wool sweater vest, which I love. It's been really cool because it looks amazing on men and women and all different body types in between, because it's just so classic. Like, it's a sweater vest, and they're coming back in, which is really cool to see. And then we found it was really hard to sell wool 4 seasons out of the year. So we started researching other sustainable fibers, and we found this amazing cotton that we were super excited to work with. From that, you know, we did another V-neck, like a ribbed V-neck. What else? Some of our styles were complete accidents, honestly. We started doing a tank top, and I did come up with, like, kind of a traditional tank top, traditional fitting tank top. And then I was going to make a small, and I made one that was just way too short. And we were like, oh my, like, no one's going to wear that. It's ridiculous. And then this young woman tried it on, and it was a perfect crop top. You know what I mean? Oh, like, high-waisted jeans, right, which are totally back, a little bit of a crop thing going on. And it was beautiful. And we were like, oh, okay, well, now we have a new style. We have a crop top.
Yeah.
The V-neck, we were just kind of looking at the file, and we were like, I wonder if I could make it 4 times longer. And I did, and now it's a sweater dress. And I love that so much.
I'm going to give people the website. It's muralsofvermont.com, because sometimes we talk about these things, and people are like, I got to see it.
Yeah,
and
the visual representation.
Yeah, so if you go to muralsofvermont.com, you'll be able to find it. You're in this business now, but if you weren't making these beautiful garments, what would you be doing? Was this always the plan to be in some kind of fashion or fashion design? Or
No, absolutely not, actually. I mean, I've always had – you know, I've always really enjoyed fashion. I find it really fun to dress up, look good, you know,
right.
Be conscious of your outfits. I'd probably be a ski bum working at a ski resort right now.
That's funny because I was going to ask you, would you have been a ski bum?
Or? Exactly. Yep. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I went to school post high school for film. I did a film program for a year. So the visual arts was kind of something that I was really interested in, but I was very intimidated by that world and just the idea of like turning something that I love to do into something that I wouldn't love to do because it was work. And the sweater thing was my mom's idea originally. And as she was like researching these machines and this technology, we were looking at the computer software that went along with it, and we were kind of like, well, my just technical skills from video editing are somewhat translatable.
Oh,
I mean, just the idea of being computer savvy is translatable. And so she was kind of like, do you want to do this with me? And I was like, yeah, I mean, it's either this or hang out at a ski resort, and this sounds a little more fun. So,
and let's talk about your mom, Laura Jacoby. She's got a completely different business, right? She was not in the garment business.
No, neither of us have a fashion background at all, actually. She was in the NGO world for a very long time, mostly overseas relief. When I was growing up, she kind of settled into a nice position at Old Spokes Home in Burlington, Vermont, doing a lot of their community outreach stuff. I hope I'm phrasing that right. But and then while she was doing that, we were kind of developing the sweater business. And just last year, we both quit our day jobs and are full-time sweater makers now.
So. Oh, I love this so much. Let's talk about the fibers you're using and where they're coming from. First of all, wool. What typifies the wool that's coming from Vermont sheep that you use? Do you use wool from Vermont
sheep? We do. So we honestly, that's how this whole idea started, was Vermont wool. My mother and specifically, but also myself, obviously are huge supporters of Vermont agriculture, buying local, and also Vermont wool farmers. The way that they manage their farms actually does a lot to sequester carbon, so kind of helping out the environment as well, doing anything and everything we can for, you know, the future of Vermont and the earth. So we wanted to source as locally as we could, and we started working with Vermont wool farmers, Vermont sheep farmers, to buy their wool at a fair price, which is kind of hard for them because a lot of the wool is almost a byproduct of their farms. A lot of Vermont sheep farmers raise sheep for meat, and the wool tends to just kind of sit. They have to shear every year, so they get a lot of it, and you can only hand knit so much so quickly. So with the machine, it allows us to knit up a lot more of that wool that would otherwise be sitting around and sell it at a better price point, and then go back and buy more wool from more Vermont farmers and hopefully expand into other farms. We've actually started working with a farm in New Hampshire. This farmer has started to breed very specifically for fleece get these like beautiful browns and grays that are completely natural, not dyed at all.
Yeah, I've seen those.
Yeah, they're gorgeous.
I can't believe it.
So fun. And so we buy from the Vermont farmers and then we send it to spinneries. There's one spinnery in Putney, Vermont, another one in Battenkill, New York, right across the lake. And they spin it for us, and I get it in these cones, and it runs through my machine, and out the other end comes a beautiful wool sweater. So it's been really cool, and the wool is really our favorite, and it's amazing to work with. It's hard to sell wool 4 seasons out of the year.
Right.
So we started looking for alternative, ethical and sustainable fibers. And hemp is actually a big thing that we would love to start working with more. It's hard right now. There's a ton of hemp being grown in Vermont, but there's zero processing for fiber.
Right.
So basically you needed another giant machine that grinds the hemp fiber down into this really, really tiny fibers. So we were looking around and we found a company that sells cotton, and they're actually based out of Italy. So we source our cotton from Italy because they have these really cool recycling processes where they can take pre-consumer cotton and they basically re-spin it with organic cotton. So it comes out to be about a 50% recycled, 50% organic blend. And then they dye it there as well. And the dyeing processes overseas, particularly in Europe, are much more regulated, so the amount of like chemical runoff that they can create in their dye factories is a lot less compared to things that we do here in the U.S. So with all those factors, we kind of saw that as like the best next fiber to kind of work with, and so we started creating these like beautiful cotton garments, sweaters for like cool summer evenings or going into shoulder seasons, and then also like tank tops and crop tops and things like that for like actually hot days, which we're getting a lot more of now. So
let's take a call. We've got Ray joining us from South Hero. Hi, Ray. Go right ahead.
No way.
Go ahead, Ray. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, Ray.
Hey, Granddad.
Oh.
How did you know it was me?
Ray from South Hero. There aren't too many of those.
How proud of this guy are you, Ray?
Listen, you're doing a great job.
Yeah.
Thank you for getting on the radio.
All right.
Too bad you missed the time. But keep up the good work.
Excellent. Oh, well, it's nice encouragement. Thanks for that, Granddad. Oh, wow. Lovely to hear that. There's something else you use. It's called Tencel. Now, what is
Tencel.
That? Tencel.
Tencel is it's another plant-based fiber. So I believe the Tencel we get is from North or South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
It's a plant-based fiber. It's basically a stock that's ground down super fine and then spun in. And we blend that with wool to create a yarn that's a lot softer, a little more lightweight than 100% wool. It also takes a lot of the itch factor out of what 100% wool would be.
Sure.
Not quite as, like, warm, not quite as, like, water-repellent, really cool technical aspects of wool aren't there as much, but it's also a nice thing for, it is a little lighter, so it's nice for shoulder seasons. It's also really nice for people that have a hard time with the itchiness of wool.
You must have done, you and your mother must have done a ton of research on fibers before you launched this, because, I hear you talk about it and you understand it quite well, but this was probably not something that you were really versed in, were you, before this?
I knew nothing before this. I absolutely knew nothing. I still don't know much. She is a lot better at doing the research than I am. I am a little more production. I kind of get the fibers and go, hey, this works great in my machine. We should keep getting something like this. Yeah. Or this is awful. Please don't ever buy this again. But yeah, I mean, and we probably should have done more research before launching the company. It is a little bit of like, hey, what works? What doesn't work?
Yeah.
And figuring that out as we go. But it's been a lot of fun, and it's been really cool to like work with different types of fibers and kind of see the whole process of what it takes to go from, I mean, from on a sheep or in the ground to on someone's body.
Well, Cyrus, I think that preparation, I think every business that's ever started could say, oh, if we had only done a little bit more, we would have known. But a lot of it, you have to start operating, and you'll figure it out eventually. How should your sweaters be cared for?
It depends on the fiber.
Right.
Our wool sweaters, we suggest hand wash and then air dry. The cotton, we suggest inside out, cold water, delicate cycle, and then again, air dry. It's not – for with the wool, it's not even really about shrinkage. All of our sweaters, the way that we treat them, my mom finishes them and then soaks them in a botanical and, like, vinegar soak in order to soften them up. Uh-huh. And then she dries them on high heat. So really the majority of shrinking should have already happened in the sweater. It shouldn't shrink any more than that. It's just a matter of, like, the stitching going through a lot of – wear and tear pretty much, right? If you want your sweater to last forever, you wash it by hand all the time.
Yeah.
Personally, I throw mine in the washer machine. Okay. I have access to a little more than everyone else does. I can always make myself a new one. But yeah, and also, I mean, it is, I also kind of try and beat mine up a little bit just to see what they can go through, you know?
Oh,
and
interesting.
They're incredibly durable. I mean, really, like, I would strongly recommend hand wash, but if you just don't have the time sometimes, it's okay.
Yeah. Now, we've mentioned on Saturdays you're at the Burlington Farmers Market. You're at the Champlain Islands Farmers Market. Where else can people find your sweaters?
Well, you mentioned the website. We offer everything and everything online. I'm more or less make to order. So I try – like another big part of this business was the idea of fast fashion and the amount that people consume and then throw away. So I try not to ever overproduce anything. I try and keep samples of everything. But if you order something online, I usually make it 2 to 3 days after.
Oh my gosh.
And then it takes my mom a little time to hand finish. And then we get it in the mail, and we say about 2 weeks to get it out to you. To see us in person, like you said, every Saturday – Grand Isle and Burlington, and then every other Sunday we're in Stowe Farmers Market and Winooski Farmers Market. So this coming up Sunday will be in Stowe and Winooski as well, and then every other after that. So
got about 30 seconds left. The reaction I had seeing that tent, your sweaters, I came rushing over. I had that look. Your mom was probably a little frightened seeing me charging at the mannequin. But do you get that a lot at when you're at these farmers markets?
People get very excited about it. It's really cool. I think partially because the designs are absolutely gorgeous, and then you get the mission, you hear the mission, you hear that it's local wool, sustainable fibers, and it's something that you don't see a whole lot, and you know, I think it's really great to have more of these things coming together in Vermont. Locally made clothes is really like a whole new movement, and we're so excited to be in it.
And reasonably priced. Cyrus Brooks designs and creates the clothing of Muriels of Vermont, and his mother, Laura, lovingly finishes them. To learn more, you can visit them at murielsofvermont.com or visit them at the Burlington Champlain Farmers Markets, Winooski, and what was the other one?
Stowe.
Stowe. All right. Cyrus, thanks so much for being on the show this morning.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a break for CBS News. Then we'll hear about former President Trump's legal concerns. And coming up today at 1, we've got Travels with Charlie with host Charlie Papillo. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, You opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. New York District Attorney's January 6th committee, FBI raid at Mar-a-Lago. Right now, there's some serious stuff happening for former President Donald Trump. But what is part of what? Why is this happening? And will any of it stop his plans to make America something again in 2024? Time to turn to Vermont Law and Graduate School professor and constitutional law expert Jared Carter. Jared, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint. Welcome back.
Yeah, great to be back, Rick, and always happy to chat with you.
Great. It's great having you. Listeners, if you've got a question about the Trump legal situation and what it all means, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jared, can you kind of untie the knots a little and give us an idea of what Donald Trump is facing legally?
Untie the knots. I think that's a great way to think about it. There is a huge knot in terms of what he's facing legally. As you said in the run-up, we've got civil investigations into business fraud in New York, criminal investigations in New York. We've got investigations in Georgia with the whole kerfuffle over calling up the Georgia Secretary of State and asking him to find votes. We've got the January 6th hearings, which have concluded and apparently been referred to the DOJ, and now we've got this Mar-a-Lago raid, and I'm probably missing six or seven others in there. So it really is a knot that former President Trump is in, and I guess the question is to play out the metaphor a little more, right? What are they going to tighten the knot and catch him in something, or is he going to continue the Houdini acts and avoid getting snarled up in the knot?
Well, let's start in New York. What has the New York Attorney General been investigating?
So I think the New York Attorney General primarily has been focusing on civil questions and civil claims against the former president and his organization, the Trump Organization. Essentially looking at whether or not they inflated values to investors, to banks, basically whether they engaged in financial chicanery to get loans and to function as a business. And so that's what we saw most recently, I guess this past week, with the former president pleading the Fifth. The right against incriminating oneself when he finally had to sit for that deposition. So that's a civil case. That's going to be, fines. It's not a criminal case. And that's really what she's looking at.
And he did plead the Fifth. Was it over 400 times during the deposition?
I think that's right. He released a statement just before saying that was what he was going to do. Under the case law, you do actually have to assert that right each time a question is asked. As a general rule, you can't sort of issue a blanket, I'm going to plead the Fifth. So you need that specificity. But that's right. And I think there's all sorts of questions over why you would do that. In a civil case in particular, the jury or the trier of fact, if it ever gets to trial, is actually allowed to infer whatever it wants based on someone pleading the Fifth. And there's a great quote from Justice Brandeis of the U.S. Supreme Court a bunch of years ago, basically saying that silence has a lot of meaning. Silence is persuasive. So the fact that he pled the Fifth in a civil context, if that gets to trial, the jury or the judge is going to get to say, well, you didn't answer the questions. What does that mean? That tends to indicate guilt. Important difference in any criminal cases, and I think this is why he pled the Fifth in the civil, any criminal cases that are going on out there, you aren't allowed to draw that inference under the Fifth Amendment. The judge is actually required to instruct the jury, hey, jury, you can't infer anything about guilt because they exercise their Fifth Amendment right. So it's an interesting sort of back and forth between the two systems, but it's certainly a knot that the former president's in.
That is, a massive difference between civil and criminal cases. One that I can't believe I've never known. Not that I follow legal situations very closely, but that's an important nuance. That could be somewhat damaging. Interesting. And if evidence is found elsewhere, then this could certainly hurt Mr. Trump by having pleaded the Fifth.
That's right. So just because somebody pleads the Fifth doesn't mean prosecutors can't go out and find, or investigators can't go out and find that evidence elsewhere. So, for example, in his closet at Mar-a-Lago. And if that's legally obtained, then they can certainly use that. And look, it's not uncommon. I mean, most people accused of civil or criminal infractions, generally say, well, I didn't do it. I'm not guilty. And so it's certainly not uncommon in a criminal context to plead the Fifth. But because of that sort of inference that's allowed in a civil context, which is what the Attorney General of New York is investigating, I think it was a little odd, and people rightfully could read into that. He must be worried about, some sort of criminal investigation if he were to say anything outside of the civil. And we'll see what comes out, what comes of the Mar-a-Lago raid. I mean, that's a whole nother ball of wax, so to speak. But,
yeah. And we'll dive into that. But I just want to make sure we understand constitutionally what that right is. I would imagine it's from the Fifth Amendment. But what the specific right is that we have, protected by the Constitution.
That's right. Under the Fifth Amendment, you have a right to not incriminate yourself. I think the idea is we make the prosecution team carry its burden of proving guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And if they were allowed to force you to admit to something, then they could essentially avoid having to meet that burden. So I think that right is really tied up with the whole principle of innocent until proven guilty. So it's a really important right. Everybody has it, and it protects you from sort of the coercive power of the prosecutors and the police. You can imagine a defendant sitting in an interrogation room, and that's a pretty intimidating prospect if you're staring down the possibility of jail time. And you might admit things as part of a deal. And if you don't have your lawyer present, or you aren't aware or told of your right to remain silent, then the courts have said that's a violation. And the reason that the U.S. Supreme Court has said that you can't infer guilt in a criminal case because of somebody claiming their Fifth Amendment right is for that very purpose. The right would be fairly meaningless if a prosecutor were allowed to say, well, this person claimed the Fifth Amendment right, so, their silence must mean something. If a jury was allowed to make that inference in a criminal case, it would essentially eviscerate the right. So that's basically where it stands, and it's an important difference between a civil case and a criminal case.
Now, I hate to put words in other people's mouths, so I just want to make sure. But I thought Mr. Trump in the past has said, that those who have taken the Fifth, that if you're innocent, why are you afraid to answer? And now he's invoked it, over 400 times in this one deposition.
Well, I think people can think what they want about former President Trump, but certainly anybody looking at this objectively can see the hypocrisy in those statements. And in fact, he brought this up preemptively in the statement he released just before going in and pleading the Fifth 400 times, where he referenced the fact that he said that, made that statement, and then essentially said, now I know why people do it. So look, the former president's strategy has always been, before he was president, in his career in New York City and elsewhere, is to really litigate every issue, stonewall every attempt to litigate on the other side, and sort of a scorched earth legal policy, legal strategy. He's not the only one to take it, and it can be very effective. But that's tends to have been his MO.
Jared, let's move to that visit that was paid by the FBI to Mar-a-Lago last week. Is this tied to New York Attorney General Letitia James' investigation into the Trump Organization for fraud?
Well, I don't think it's tied to that investigation. That's the state of New York's investigation, and this was the feds, the FBI.
Oh, right.
So it's more likely tied into something that the Department of Justice and the federal attorney general is investigating. But I think if folks are right to sort of think this is all swirling together, because in many respects it is all swirling together. And there's so many of these investigations that it's sort of hard to keep track of what applies to what. And certainly the federal and state governments, when they're investigating a possible defendant, can communicate with each other, and they can and do share evidence and information. But I think what happened in Florida is much more likely relevant to the Department of Justice's investigation into any violations of civil or criminal laws that Trump may have done.
And so we don't know specifically what those are?
Well, I know there's been some different ideas floated around, obstruction of justice again, the Espionage Act. There's laws about how you need to maintain confidential documents. Where this all gets very interesting in my mind from a legal perspective is what is the president's and former president's authority to declassify classified documents. And the courts have been pretty friendly towards presidents, and they do have very broad power to declassify documents. So I do think there's something to this question of whether former President Trump declassified even informally all of these documents before loading them in the U-Haul and driving them down to Mar-a-Lago from D.C. And if he did, what's the legal implication of that? Does that mean that they aren't actually classified? And there's, I think, arguments to be made on both sides of that. I think there's also a question of has current President Biden reclassified those documents? So just as it would have been easy for President Trump to declassify many of them, perhaps, it would also be just as easy for President Biden to say, well, everything that Trump and his family loaded in the U-Haul pertaining to X is now classified again. So it's a really interesting, from an academic perspective, question. I don't know whether it's good for our society and our politics. In fact, right. It probably is not. But
Now, do ex-presidents tend to take home some documents at the end of their term?
Well, there have been instances where that's happened in the past. I don't know the specifics of it, but I was actually reading something about LBJ, I believe, doing that. Trump has said that Obama took stuff home when he was in office. I don't know of any instance, though, where something of this nature has happened, particularly if it does turn out to be things related to our nuclear programs or foreign interests. That would really be unprecedented. It'll be interesting to see what folks say if and when that information comes out.
I gotcha. And I think some were supposed to be returned to the National Archives. That seems like kind of the weakest of all reasons to go to Mar-a-Lago with FBI and cart off 15 cases of documents. So is that a big point of why they were sent there to pick up documents?
Well, look, the Attorney General, as a prosecutor and his team, have prosecutorial discretion to decide what claims to prosecute. I would be very surprised if the only thing they were looking for and the only possible crime they were going to prosecute was essentially the president's failure, sort of technical failure, to turn over a few documents to the National Archives. While that's possible, I don't think they're unaware. Their heads aren't in the sand. They're aware of the politics and the parameters of all of this. So I think it's much more likely there's something that they're looking at that's much more serious.
And they wouldn't have waited a year and a half and right before an election to do that if that's all they were looking for. Is that a fair point?
I think that's a fair point. I do think that the DOJ is traditionally and historically been independent and tries to be independent from politics,
right,
as much as they can be. But you're right, an election's coming up. There's no way this doesn't get seen through a political lens. I'm sure they're aware of that. That's why I think it's pretty unlikely that we're just talking about a couple of, you know, cocktail notes with some handwriting on them that should have been at the National Archives.
And on Fridays, I have former Congressman, Ohio Congressman Bob Ney on the show, and he was caught up in the Jack Abramoff scandal. He did have the FBI come and seize documents, but he said he was informed ahead of time that that was going to take place. You know, it seems in this situation that was not the case by the FBI. So the way they conducted the quote-unquote raid on Mar-a-Lago, is it different than other similar situations normally conducted by the FBI?
Well, look, as far as I can tell, there had been an ongoing back and forth between the FBI and Trump and his attorneys over the past several months about documents at Mar-a-Lago. And then apparently they got some documents back, but then learned that there were others that were marked confidential, top secret, that they had been told weren't there. It turned out they were. Now, we don't know what they are, what they could be, but there was obviously a concern that that evidence was going to disappear. And folks might remember, and who knows what the validity of all this is, about the same time that this was happening, there were some articles that came out indicating that the former president in the White House, you know, had a tendency to flush documents down the toilet. So whether that's all connected or not, I think it's speculation. But I think they had noticed that this process was going on. And then, yeah, the FBI and law enforcement regularly execute warrants without giving people a heads up in advance, especially if they're trying to prevent the destruction of evidence.
Right. I would think that's the proper way to go about this. Let's move on to the January 6th committee. What we've heard so far, you know, is, you know, to the novice like me, somewhat damning to President Trump's reputation. But looking at it legally, Jared, you know, what could he be charged with?
Well, I mean, again, when it comes to the January 6th hearings, right, they're not looking at criminal prosecution. Congress has no authority to prosecute any crimes. So I think those were very much more about giving the American people an opportunity to have this dialogue, to learn about this, to really dig into trying to figure out what happened. And then certainly that evidence can and has, to my understanding, been turned over to the Department of Justice.
Right.
And it would be their prerogative or not to prosecute the president. And those that very well may have been the impetus for the raid at Mar-a-Lago, in addition to the National Archives bit, because they are considering prosecuting for whether it's Espionage Act, obstruction of justice, et cetera, incitement. They could very well be looking at those things, and that evidence at Mar-a-Lago was part of it. But it's not Congress's job to prosecute. They simply hold those hearings, and it's more of a political process than a legal one.
And if the DOJ was able to make any of those charges stick, would that prevent the former President Trump from seeking higher office again?
Well, I think so. That's the $10,000 question.
Okay.
Obviously, if the president were convicted, it would make it very hard for him to run for office. Although, as he said, at previous times, you know, he could basically do whatever he wants, and people would still vote for him. I do think there's a segment of the population out there that even if he was sitting behind bars, would vote for him.
No doubt.
You know, I think there's sort of the folks somewhere in the middle. Maybe they voted for him in 2016, maybe in 2020. Important to point out, though, that President Trump has never won the popular vote.
That's correct.
And so the question becomes, does all of this politically, regardless of whether he's behind bars in the future, does all of this politically harm him? And to my mind, I think to most Americans, the answer is yes.
Gotcha. Jared Carter is a Vermont Law and Graduate School professor and constitutional law expert. Jared, thanks so much for untying all that. It really feels a clearer picture with having you on today. Thank you so much.
You bet, Rick. Great to chat with you.
Great having you. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivrigan. Feel free to suggest guests or topics by emailing us at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint and subscribe to them at wdevradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we discuss recycled mattresses, confusing warblers, the Inflation Reduction Act, and squiggonometry.